when the force and the intuition of compassion is cultivated, it is a natural response to any form of suffering. And this response is referred to as a quivering in the heart, a sensation, with the sense associated with this sensation that one wishes to, in some way, be of assistance in the face of suffering. This is generally an outward going awareness. And when it is completely an outer going awareness, or just in reference to others, then one is subject to what's referred to, perhaps unkindly, but nonetheless, fool's compassion. Because there's no balance in it. And so one can stumble over this kind of compassion. Whereas if compassion includes one's own personal experience, if compassion has penetrated into the recognition of the suffering that exists within our own individual heart, then this endows the experience of this quivering and this desire to dissipate suffering with wisdom. One aspect of wisdom is equanimity, something that we'll study very directly through our own equanimity practice for those who wish in a couple of days. But the compassion that is conjoined with equanimity is capable of recognizing suffering and doing what it is capable of doing, doing what one is capable of doing. But in the extensions of kindness and care, if there is no curative, let's say, result, if the problem is not resolved, then there's a sense of respect that arises, a sense of bowing to the fact that the conditions are karmic, and something that one is to perhaps learn from, and to want to deprive ourselves and another of suffering out of this sense that we cannot bear it, is to deprive the potential within that karma for growth, the growth of wisdom. One variation on the phrase that I sometimes use for karuna, when suffering is very present, is may this suffering deepen into wisdom and compassion. We cannot know what the purifying fires of suffering might come to in another individual. In fact, it's said that with a compassionate approach, that in the midst of suffering, there's a potential for insight to arise in a matter that is worth more than 100 years of health. And this is not to say that we should disdain our good fortune when there are times of health, but it's to state that we should not underestimate the power of suffering if it's something that is a part of one's individual karma. I was noticing just a few months ago this interesting tendency in my practice, and I'm holding it as a kind of contemplation, but the most powerful practice I've ever done has been when the levels of anguish and psychic and emotional pain have been most acute. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that's because something very, very challenging is going on in particular in this moment or that moment of my life. But in intensive practice, sometimes we open to levels of pain that require a certain fine, I want to say exquisite, quality of attention that brings about a certain transformation. I have seen this. And I've pondered over it because it became clear to me recently. Particularly, I pondered over it when I was sitting with a particular meditation master, and his kind of the phrase that he would use most to inspire, which I thought was rather dire and dark, was that pain is the door to nirvana. It wasn't that I didn't know that it was true to some degree, that it's through suffering that there is transformation. But it was more his emphasis around sort of giving a holy reverence to suffering, so that he really did want us to suffer a great deal, and so would set certain conditions that would, for instance, give rise to physical suffering or emotional suffering. And in fact, his attending monk giving a Dhamma talk one evening talked about this time in his practice where there was such excruciating pain that he fainted, and how much respect there was for him amongst the other monks. Knowing some distinction between a monastic view and approach to life and a lay view, I understand that the monastic view is born of what my root teacher Zen master Tsongsa used to say was the hard path. But I don't think it's necessary to produce suffering intentionally. I think that suffering exists, and that there are times of relaxation and intensity that occur in our lives that allow for us as well to cultivate other qualities that provide us with the strength to face the times when the vicissitudes bring about certain conditions that are harsh and are difficult. And so I look particularly at compassion from a place of love and a place of, and this may sound repetitive, of compassion. And yet there is a kind of strange irony that we do create our own suffering to a great degree. And compassion in its strength of insight is able to help us to recognize this, to recognize, oh, that there are certain habits and certain behaviors and certain beliefs and certain tendencies and certain approaches to life and certain energies that galvanize our attention and certain ways that we have of engaging our own minds and bodies that do, and others' minds and bodies, that do lead to suffering. And it's through this recognition, through this kind recognition, the recognition of the pain inherent in this process, that the heart opens to this unifying factor of compassion. This increasing understanding that in fact we can choose not to suffer, as opposed to this approach that we must somehow produce more suffering in order to experience liberation. I've seen, and this is not always the case, and every monastic does not hold this view, but I have seen this view expressed in the monastic belief. As I mentioned earlier, compassion is a form of intelligence. And as it grows and as it deepens as a form of intelligence, then we begin to learn from a four chapter story that I told a yogi earlier. And the story goes like this. The first chapter is that I'm walking down the street and I fall into a pit and I can't get out. Chapter 2 is I'm walking down the street and I fall into a pit and I think I can't get out, but I do. Chapter number 4 is I'm walking down the street, I fall into the pit and I get out. And chapter number 4 is that I'm walking down the street, I see a pit in front of me and I walk around it. There is a particular quality that awakens with a compassion that has a terrible translation. Its translation is moral dread. But again, it's an intuitive factor that senses the potential for suffering. And actually, out of this intuitive awareness, there's a navigating around the suffering. And I find this principle very interesting, because oftentimes, without knowing it, we leave ourselves open to unnecessary suffering, as if we're asking for it. You know that experience that we've all had where, in retrospect, we say, you know, I knew it. I knew I was making the wrong decision. And yet, I went ahead and did it. And it's a perplexing experience that we have, where we overlook the truth of suffering or something that indicates that something is going to bring us suffering or the outcome of some action is going to be suffering, and yet we choose. We choose to suffer. And then later on we say, I knew that this is going to lead to suffering. Well, this quality of moral dread is that instinct that protects oneself from that pattern. And again, it's an instinct that arises with the concentration of Karuna Bhavana. Rather than just falling into the pit and remaining there out of despair and the belief that we can't get out, we just get out. We say, you know, this situation or this pattern, this thought, however subtle or gross the options are, simply doesn't work for me. I can see that it's causing me harm. I can see that we're causing one another harm. And therefore, we have to stop. I have to stop. Very difficult to do this. But the ability to recognize suffering comes from our own compassion. As the heart grows in compassion, it also becomes a very powerful motivation in practice. In fact, one can contemplate this at the beginning of any practice session. In fact, I've seen where it's extremely helpful if one does not have motivation to practice, to simply put it within the framework of, I practice for the benefit of myself and all beings. And as compassion grows, we recognize that, yes, the practice is an act of compassion. And the heart can open to receive energies, sustaining energies, throughout our practice, if it ever becomes very dry for us or seemingly distant, or some people have mentioned to uninspiring or boring, one can just stop for a moment and renew one's motivation by simply stating that one is going to continue to practice in order to benefit oneself and all beings. Because within the practice itself, this quality of compassion is awakening, and compassion is the great equalizer. When compassion is strong, it's very, very difficult to feel separate from other human beings. It's different than metta. It's the kind of connection that we feel because we recognize that each being, it is said, is more tender than the sepals of a flower. And to connect from one's own experience of this level of tenderness and open-heartedness is to have a resonance, to establish a resonance, to be in resonance with this tenderness within all beings. I have a friend who had the unfortunate experience of losing his son. His son died. It was a tragic situation where this young man was with friends, and somebody said, "Oh, you know, I got this great stuff, and, you know, would you like to try it?" "Well, what is it?" "Oh, it's heroin." "Oh, I don't know. Yeah, let's do it." "Okay." So he died from a heroin overdose. It wasn't good stuff, it was bad stuff. His father walked into his bedroom to get him up in the morning to go to school, just in time to be able to enfold him in his arms. This young man died within in his arms. And, I mean, just in the speaking of it, I feel such extraordinary grief. I can't even imagine that sense of tragedy and loss. It was shocking for so many of us. It was like a raw bolt in our hearts. How could such a cruel experience happen in life? The entire community rallied in compassion. And then it was about, oh, I don't know, 6 months, a year, maybe slightly longer, that I saw my friend. And I was still kind of in that place of sorrow and shock for this person. And I was projecting that onto this individual when I saw him. And what he said was very interesting. He said that the extraordinary amount of suffering that he and his family had experienced also became a kind of communion, where his sense of his sorrow and loss and pain then became the awareness of this phenomena in the lives of so many other human beings. That he has the great honor of sharing tears with so many human beings. Kuan Yin is oftentimes depicted as the goddess of compassion. And actually, in fact, Kuan Yin is not always depicted as a female, in some cultures as a male. But in a particular rendering of Kuan Yin, she holds a vase. Sometimes the vase is held slightly slanted down, depicting the ocean of tears that is pouring through this vase. And it's in this ocean of sorrow that one meets this goddess, Kuan Yin, this saving grace. One time when I was crying, when I was experiencing sorrow, I tasted the tears and realized that the tears taste just like ocean water. And I had that sense of the ocean of sorrow. Or the ocean as a body of water that, yes, you know, we know the laws of nature and science, but it's as if sometimes the sky is crying. Oh, the sky is crying today. The sky is crying for the extraordinary suffering of the human beings and other beings on this earth. The sky is crying for me in this moment of sadness. Sadness opened up for me in a way that wasn't so tragic, or shall I say, hasn't yet taken such a tragic form, I don't know. But it opened when I had decided that I was going to do a 2-month retreat in my home. I was compelled for a period of time. I just kept feeling this vortex of silence and stillness that wanted to be attended to. And so I checked with my family and checked with my friends, and I had the support that was necessary to do this retreat in my home. And I happened to live in a home where we had also invited others to live with us and to practice. And so it was a kind of ideal situation. And I remember the first day of the retreat, the very first day. And I was sitting, and it actually was marked by the fact, although this isn't the reason I chose to do the retreat, it was a historical mark for me because I had been for a number of years a student of Zen and fortunate to be under the guidance of a very charismatic and powerful teacher. And I was very grateful, but it became clear that it wasn't my native practice. And so I said thank you and departed. And so I was sitting this first day in the retreat, and suddenly there was just this burst of tears. And then the tears became sobbing. And the perception was that somebody had taken a little hammer and had just kind of lightly tapped the top of my head, and this kind of porcelain view of perfectionism fell away. And it was the perfectionism associated with my training in Zen. You know, you sit like a mountain. You sit like a mountain, and you're praised for this quality of non-moving attention. That's a very, or was a very kind of striving-oriented practice. Not to say that I did not benefit from it immeasurably. But it was time for that porcelain impression of perfectionism to fall away. And in the process, I fell forward. I had no spine. That perfectionism had been holding me up and keeping me separate from the heart. And what poured out was this extraordinary sorrow. And so while on the floor, you know, just kind of flat on the floor, sobbing, I just had the sense of allowing it to happen, as if not to obstruct it in any way, not to obstruct this flow of energy, because it felt like it was going to the ocean. And I had the sense, yes, of course, this is what I've always been afraid of. And then when the sobbing subsided and I got up and I went to the bathroom and I washed my hands and decided to put a little bit of cold water on my sore eyes, I just happened to look up and catch a glimpse of myself, you know, in the mirror, all swollen and distorted. And I thought, yes, this is why I've been wearing a mask. Because I didn't want people to see the depth of sorrow in my heart. I didn't want it to be witnessed. I felt ashamed of it. It became a matter of integrity in the practice, whenever sorrow arose, to cultivate compassion, to invite it, so that there was nothing there to obstruct it. I couldn't always be in a sobbing state, you know, with that level of intention, but just that sense of karuna, allowing the sorrow to arise, and to be known completely. And this became very inconvenient, because it would arise at odd times. You know, the sorrow would arise, and tears would arise, but it just is a phase in our practice when we can begin to allow ourselves to experience sorrow and sadness, where there's enough trust at some level to open to its depths. So there was an experience one time where I was had agreed to go to the courthouse with a friend who had a difficult situation to face, and I thought to myself that morning as I got up and started crying, I can't go, I'm crying. And then I thought, that's ridiculous, you know, I'm going to go anyway. Cried all the way to the courthouse, parked the car, sat there crying, for no reason. It was just that it was the opportunity to experience the sadness that had been blocked for such a long time. And so I just thought, okay, I'll walk into the courthouse, I'll find my friend, and continue to cry. But what was really interesting is that no one noticed. And I understood that we all live behind this veil of resistance to our own experience of sadness and others. So it was as if it was an invisible experience. And so in a certain way I was safe, you know. And I just went about my business of being a supportive friend. And I saw another degree of this blindness. I witnessed another degree of this blindness. One time when I was in my apartment, an apartment that I lived in at one point, and I heard somebody screaming outside. Just screaming. But it was more than screaming. It was screeching, and it was more than screeching. It was full of, you know, primitive energy, and it was just a primal sound. And in the listening of it, you know, I thought, what is this? You know, what is this? So I went out onto my porch, and I saw around the corner of this wall this man who was in this primal rage and anguish. And so I had the sense that what it represented was that no one had ever heard nor seen his suffering. And so in that moment, I brought karuna to bear in order to allow myself to listen. And what was interesting in the listening was that it must have been a weekend, because there was a family walking by and there was an ice cream store not too far, and people were just kind of strolling along. And no one noticed. And he was screaming. Absolutely no one took him into their awareness. And I just had the sense that, yes, of course, there's some place within us that is screaming for attention. But we're so ashamed of that level of need, of attention. And the truth of the matter is that the only one that can bring that attention to this place of such pain and sorrow and anguish is oneself. That compassion is a reunion with self, not just with others. And it's the willingness to witness, to bear witness and to open to all the pain that exists that has never ever been felt nor witnessed. And that no one else can do this for another human being. Not really. There can be moments of kindness. There can be moments of witnessing. But only I can open to the depth of my own suffering. And it exists at that primitive level that I heard in the sound of that anguished being. It exists at that level within all of us. And with compassion, there's something very beautiful for me in that sense of the slow opening also being a slow descent into the expanse of heart that includes this depth of suffering that we have been avoiding. Sometimes I see it as the fear of drowning. We're feared of drowning in our sorrow. And what's very interesting is that there's a certain principle that I learned one time while swimming that relates here. I lived one time by a lake, and I noticed one time when I was swimming that I was staying very close to the edge. And I wondered why, because I used to like to swim distances, as I mentioned. And I noticed that it was because of the coldness in the water and that association I had somehow. You know, I don't want to go there. And I just wondered about it, and I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is swim out every day just a little bit further. Just a little bit further. And then just kind of paddle around, you know, to see what it brings up in the mind. This is the kind of opposite story of this foolhardy business of riding currents and, you know. And to develop pride. This was more a matter of curiosity and investigation. So I would swim out a little bit, and then I'd stop, and I would just watch the kind of reactions in the body and in the mind, and swim out a little bit more. And really what began to happen was that I noticed that as I became more interested in the experience, I became less fearful. And as I became less fearful, I became more buoyant, and I would just kind of float there, you know, like a balloon. And I realized it was because of the fact that the less fearful I became, the more constant the breath became. The body wasn't depriving itself of breath. And so at one point when I finally did get out to the middle, I just thought to myself, oh, let me just relax here. And I sort of just laid back into the body, and suddenly the legs came up and the arms went out. And the body was completely buoyant. And I'm liking this to the cultivation of karuna as a mindfulness practice, that the mindfulness cultivated as an extension through karuna allows for us to be able to breathe in the face of suffering. It allows for us to remain buoyant and upright, rather than drowning. Because there's a kind of interesting correlation here physiologically between that ability to open to pain and to be able to remain present to it without reactivity, and the capacity for the breath to remain open and fluid and full, rather than to withhold it. Because in the face of fear and of suffering, of sorrow, we live in a state of contraction. And so naturally, there's an association that we're going to drown if we open to this ocean. Meanwhile, as a gradualist, as a gradual process, we will learn that capacity for balance. And so, just like we hear of this process of gradual awakening, we can apply this to the fact that the practice is, in its nature, compassionate, and that therefore this opening will happen just enough determined by what we're able to handle. Another dimension of compassion that the Buddha talked about was the fact that as compassion becomes stronger, it excludes no one. In fact, the mind and its way of looking at life shifts and changes. So whether one is looking at an individual who has sterling virtue, or whether one is viewing an individual, as it's said in translation, who is vicious and overwhelmed by the hindrances, the kalesas, that one views this individual equally. Because one with sterling virtue can have a turn of mind and be overtaken by the hindrances, whereas one who lives in a state of restriction and torment and projecting this into the world is also capable of developing sterling virtue. In fact, there's a story from the time of the Buddha. There was this king named King Ashoka, the wicked. He had absolutely no compassion, and he was a tyrannical king, and brought about a great deal of suffering to his subjects. But one day, he heard a Dhamma talk, a Dhamma phrase, that turned his mind completely to the Dhamma. And over time, because of his practice, he became Ashoka the good, Ashoka the virtuous. And in fact, he is a very renowned being in the history of the Buddha's life, because he became a great supporter of the Buddha and a great supporter of Buddhism. It's taught that the Buddha continued to cultivate compassion. The Buddha's day was evidently broken down into five different parts. And in the afternoon, his habit was to take rest. And after a little rest, he would arise and he would concentrate his mind in the state of Maha Karuna. And the intention in the concentrated state of Maha Karuna was to be in resonance with his assembly, to be able to be in resonance and to be able to sense where there was suffering and to be in a state of compassion with it. And as well, it's said that he entered in a state of Maha Karuna between 5 and 6 in the morning. He concentrated Karuna to the state of a divine abiding in order to be again in attunement with those that were suffering. In fact, there's an interesting note that as a result of this, the Buddha was motivated to seek out those that were suffering in order to provide the greatest compassion, which was the support in the Dhamma. I'm not suggesting that should become our mission, that we should seek out those who are suffering in order to give them the message of Dhamma. We're talking about the Buddha. Our message is in the way that we live, and in the way that we use our minds, in the way that we use speech, in the way that we live within our bodies. Whereas, at the end of this long sentence, whereas it said that those who were good and virtuous would seek out the Buddha, that all he had to do was to be present, and those that already had a heart of metta or a heart of a karuna, to some degree, were drawn to him. And all of this because of this practice that he continued to engage, so that he would remain in resonance with the suffering world. In fact, there's a story about the inspiration that gave rise to the lifetimes lived that gave rise to Shakyamuni Buddha. And it's a story about a hermit named Sumedha. And it was because of a vision of compassion, because of a vision of sorrow and suffering of the world, that this hermit formed the conviction that lifetimes would be lived cultivating the causes and conditions that would lead to the end of suffering. And the way that it's stated formally is lifetimes lived developing the causes and conditions that would penetrate the Four Noble Truths. It's said that the Four Noble Truths, which is the essence of the Buddha's teaching, is the perfect teaching for this era of humans and devas. And so it was compassion that motivated what is stated as four immeasurables and 100,000 eons of time. I love that. It builds something very, very important into my sense of patience and dedication. It makes my impatience sometimes feel very petty. So, the Buddha arose out of this conviction that was maintained over time, and the Buddha mind penetrated the Four Noble Truths. And it's said that after this was complete, the Buddha was walking along one day without any sense of teaching. There was no motivation to teach, whatever that is. And there are various renditions of this story depending upon how it's translated. But in one, he's met by a deva. And the deva says, "Oh, you know, you're just radiant. Are you a Buddha?" And there's a very, very interesting interaction there that, again, is mistranslated oftentimes, that is really that I am not that. I simply am. And in that process, there was also this reference, well, you know, are you going to teach? And evidently there was a vision of compassion that Shakyamuni Buddha had, where he recognized that on one hand, he felt as if there was no point in teaching because nobody would understand. In fact, it's said that what he had to offer, he felt, were just like a handful of leaves. Just a handful of leaves in the dense forest of many trees. But he had this vision that there were a few beings that just had a little bit of dust in the eyes. And that therefore this motivated him, again out of compassion, to seek out his brethren, to seek out his friends, to seek out his family of origin, and to provide his presence for those who may be inclined towards the Dhamma. And as a result of that, we who have, you know, this dust in our eyes are still benefiting from his presence, even though it was 2,600 years ago. Sometimes, when I have the good fortune to feel sorrow and to experience that sense of being reunited with all being, and when the tears begin to flow, I have this sense that a part of the trust I have in that experience is that the tears are washing away just a little bit of that dust that's left. Not all of it. Because the delusion is still very, very dense, I'm sure. But every time the tears come, just a little bit more clarity. Just a little bit more clarity. A little bit more faith in the power of compassion. I think I'll just stop here. And again, whether or not you have chosen the Karuna Bhavana practice as your own for now, perhaps you can bring this practice to bear for a few moments, just out of any inspiration that you may have in your heart, out of the humble recognition of the depth of suffering that exists, that we've not yet met. And the empowerment of compassion is the means, the merciful means, that will slowly and gently bring us in touch with the suffering in a way that transforms it through liberation. Dhamma liberation. Be free from suffering and its causes. May I be willing to be free from suffering and its causes. So that when we see the little baby crying and we cannot appease this crying baby, we can hold it with faith and trust that this is a part of life. When we see the little child crying, we can say, this is good. This is good that you're crying. I care about why, but I also want you to feel free to cry. I'll hold you patiently until you feel like telling me why you're crying. It's good to cry. When somebody who is sick is crying, to open and to acknowledge the importance of the emotion of sadness. Not to try to talk the individual out of it, but to embrace the individual in its sorrow and in its tears. These are tears of purification and liberation if we can embrace them. When our elders are crying because it's the end of life, we can embrace this end of life, this fear of the unknown, with compassion, which builds strength into our ability to face the unknown. It's natural to be afraid. I'm here with you in your pain. I trust you. I know that you know your way. I see this within you. Compassion can take so many forms. The interview list. I have to laugh. My voice felt so big. Sounds like so small. About the interview list is up for the rest of the retreat. If you'd like to view it. Sweet dreams.